Good evening, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm just going to very quickly establish my bona fides. Now, if you're all really organised, you'd have all done the background research on the interwebs already and know who I am, but I'm just going to very quickly tell you. I've been in the technology business here in Cambridge for about 30 years, and I got my first job through what's charmingly known as chutzpah. When I was 14, I wrote a letter to our local computer company, Acorn Computer, asking for a job. I got a very charming letter back saying, "You're a bit young for a job, Sonny, but why don't you show up in the school holidays and we'll see if we can find you something to do." So on the first day of the school holidays, I was on the doorstep at Acorn, and the proprietor, one Herman Hauser, of whom you may have heard, handed me an Acorn computer and said, "Here, take this and see what you can do with it." So feeling rather pleased with myself, I got on the bus, went home, showed my little brother. We translated a computer game for the Commodore 64 to run on the Acorn machine. And the following morning, I got on the bus and went back in with my cassette tape, those were the days, with the game on it. And I gave it to the guys at Acorn, and they all stopped doing any work and played Star Trek on the Acorn computer all morning. And they said, "You can come back." So that lesson is about seizing opportunities. And I think that's a really important leadership's quality, which those of you who aspire to being entrepreneurs are going to need to have. It's about, you know, when somebody gives a little chink of opportunity to you, you need to actually charge right in and drive a wedge and make the most of it that you possibly can. Moving on 20 or 30 years, I've managed to have, through four businesses that I've been involved in running, a couple of businesses go public on the stock exchange. The penultimate one, ANT, is still listed there. It's a small IPTV software business. It's on one of the science parks here in Cambridge. I'm no longer involved. Other people did most of the work in the last few years, but they managed to get it listed on AIM in 2005. And the one that I'm actually, I guess, known for is a business in cryptography, internet security, which my brother and I started in 1996. It's called Encipher, and Encipher was listed on the main board of the London Stock Exchange in the heady times of the last dot-com bubble in October 2000. And I'm not going to embarrass myself with the statistics, but let's just say it was quite a success. And furthermore, I managed to stay in charge of it. Speaking of firing CEOs, I managed to remain the CEO of it for a total of 11 years, seven of them as a public company. I believe I'm still the only main board PLC that had a chief executive with a ponytail. And being an IT guy, that matters to me. And I'm pleased to say that we sold the business to Thales, the French defence contractor, in 2008. And they've taken good care of all my people, and you will still see their sign on Station Road as you go up towards the station on the right-hand side. So I'm very proud of that because I created about 250 jobs. I made about 15 times the money for my original investors. I made a bit of money for myself, and therefore I feel that I've got some experience and also some scars. So I'm going to try and recycle some of my experiences for your benefit, and also try and prevent you from making the same mistakes as me. To some extent, I promise you that you can make some different mistakes, all of your own, but hopefully, at least, if you don't make the same mistakes as me, you'll have an interesting ride. I'm going to cover some of these points, but not necessarily in this order. Due to incompetence on my part, just to be clear, these aren't necessarily in the same order as the next few slides. But don't panic. The thing that I do now is I'm a venture capital investor. So part of the reason I was asked by Shai to participate was to tell you a little bit about what investors look for. It tends to be that people look for money from investors to get their businesses started. I should just begin by saying that this is a really bad idea because actually what you should ideally do is make the money yourself. It's called profit, and then you don't need any money from people like me. So if you can possibly achieve that, I do strongly encourage it. But if you insist on taking money from an investor, then your investor is going to require the following crucial things to make their investment really feel like something they want to go ahead and do. The first of them is a really great team. The second of them is a really great team. And the third of them is a really great team. You will by now have seen a theme emerging. And the team really is absolutely the single most important thing. There is a saying about this that a great team can fix a terrible business, but a terrible team can break a great business. And, you know, in the end, business is all about people doing stuff. And if the people are competent or even great people, then they can do stuff that other people think is impossible. They can do six impossible things before breakfast, like Alice, and therefore they can achieve more than anyone ever expected of them with fewer resources. And that's really the kind of effect we're looking for here to build globally successful businesses of any variety. And it's especially what I'm looking for as a technology investor. I'm looking for teams of people who are going to be able to deliver extraordinary results. Now, clearly, a team requires constituent elements, but most of all, it does actually require one very important thing. It requires some leadership. And in fact, typically we think about the leadership role as being the one that, you know, enjoys all the publicity, because somebody has to be the person at the front. Somebody has to be the person, the shy one, like me, who stands up on stage, who evangelizes the business, who thinks nothing of being interviewed on, the radio at home in the morning, the TV at lunchtime, and the newspapers in the afternoon, who goes out and sells to customers, all of those things. And if you're sitting there thinking, gosh, that's really not the kind of thing that I want to do, then you may not be the person to be at the sharp, pointy end of a business. But that's okay. There's going to be room for lots of other people in the business. But the so-called alpha entrepreneur, the person who really wants to be that kind of person at the pointy end, is obviously a crucial and, frankly, probably over-publicised part of the team. I just want to conduct a quick experiment. If you've seen me speak, in fact, let me just ask that as a question, actually. Who has seen me speak here before at Enterprise Tuesday? Hands up, please. Okay, you are disqualified from the following experiment. You'll know why. Here is a £20 note. Who wants £20? Okay. And that was good, hands down. I'll just try it again. Who wants £20? Okay, and right, they're beginning to get the message. Okay, you did win on speed, so you can have it. Well done. All right, you also went first. So, round of applause for the... It was interesting. He made a false start, but he did get it together in the end, and he had the shortest route, which, I mean, is maybe it's luck. Maybe it's not luck. Do you think there's a reason why he sat there instead of somewhere else in the room? This really matters. This isn't just a flippant thing. If you're going to be an alpha entrepreneur, you have to be the kind of person who's going to be prepared to walk across three empty desks. It could actually be crawl across broken glass to become the person who wins the prize. So that's what I mean by alpha entrepreneur. However, we also have to have other people in the team. Okay, so the alpha entrepreneur is going to be the person who, fronts the business. They often endure a bit of a debate about whether they were the born or made. Clearly, your background, your education, your personality, all kinds of things confect together in this. And, some people are just naturally shy, like me and this guy. And some people are, even more shy. So, clearly that sort of aspect of your background, your personality is going to be important. But, there are going to be other aspects of that which inform whether or not you're really effective. Because you can't just aspire to it, you have to be good at it too. And the bad news is nobody knows whether they're good at it until they actually try doing it. So how do you find out if you're an alpha entrepreneur, besides walking across desks and crawling across broken glass? There is no answer. You just have to do it. So actually, one of the reasons that I'm now able to say that I'm a successful entrepreneur is because I was one of those kind of cliched kids who might as well have made their own lemonade stand by the side of the road. In my case, it was, writing a cheeky letter to a local company and then taking the opportunity to get in there. And I didn't know that I was going to be able to make good on that. My point was that I wasn't willing to hold back. I just got in there and tried. And, sure enough, I had pushed back at various stages. Things went wrong. I got in trouble. I eventually upset my family very deeply with the following simple device. I flunked my A-levels and I failed to go to university. Now, here I am addressing a crowd of people at a great university for which I have great respect, make no mistake. But actually, it's very common amongst entrepreneurs that they become frustrated with the standardized form of learning and they decide to break out. And by the time I was 17 and thinking about whether I was going to go to university, I actually wanted to get out of the system that I thought I was about to embark on, avoid more years in education, and actually get to work. So at a previous episode of Enterprise Tuesday, I actually had a young lady in the audience who asked me, what advantage did I think I'd gained from not going to university? And my absolutely honest answer was, 5 years head start on you, madam. Now, you're all, well, maybe not all, but many of you are involved in, a perfectly legitimate quest for knowledge through a university. I'm not trying to discourage you from that. But to some extent, you may have already somewhat disqualified yourselves by embarking on that path. So, if you're going to be an alpha entrepreneur, this is your chance to think about breaking out.
You're fired.
He says, I'm fired. You may even have heard there's actually a cheeky ploy. Peter Thiel, a well-known investor in the Valley, has actually started a prize fund for effectively sponsoring people out of university. So actually paying people to leave university because entrepreneurs sometimes fail it. I'm really not encouraging this. What I want you to do is to think, is to question, your willingness to pursue your key goals in the face of what will hopefully be a desperate wish to become a successful entrepreneur, which may ultimately mean that, the education system isn't the right solution for you. So I think, trying to be a little bit more specific, that the kinds of qualities that leaders need to have, I noticed in a slightly trite way that leadership is also here on my list of leadership qualities, you'll have to forgive me that one, but I'm very interested in the other ones. I'm particularly interested in the very first one I've listed, which for the left to right readers amongst you is integrity. It turns out that getting other people to buy into your vision revolves mostly around being consistent in your own values. Being a great leader is about getting other people to trust you, and it's very difficult to get people to trust you if you can't demonstrate integrity. So that's about not messing around in the broadest sense. That's about really showing people that you are an honest and sincere person and that you're worth working with. Nobody likes a shyster, least of all for a boss. So actually, finding out that your boss isn't somebody of high integrity is one of the most significant dangers to anybody wanting to stay in an organization. And, actually, bosses are very rarely successful if they don't have high integrity. There are some exceptions in large corporations where they can kind of float to the top. But in entrepreneurship, integrity is absolutely the most important of these. You'll perhaps accept by now that I am an example of somebody who has passion, really caring about what you do, really wanting to be successful in your chosen field, building a great business, all of those things. Those are things which you will be able to hopefully relate to. Experience is something that you can only build by actually doing it, by getting things wrong, by learning by your mistakes, by having some successes, by iterating progress. And, clearly it's necessary to know what you're talking about as well and have the skill to execute on it. I don't believe that avoiding university made me smart. It turns out what happened was I left school at 17 and I went to start work. And I ended up buying a bookcase full of books about computer science, which I spent the next few years accumulating and reading. And I actually believe that I probably ended up doing most, if not more, than an undergraduate computer science degree by myself because I needed to know. So this isn't about ignorance. It's just about how you gain the knowledge. And for me, gaining the knowledge worked better in a different way. The skill, of course, is another experiential thing. You have to actually do stuff. It turns out I can write computer code and I can design bits of electronics and solder them together, with my own bare hands. But there are better people at it than me. So I've learned what my skill level is, and it turns out that I'm better at some other kinds of things, which thankfully engineers don't want to do. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a job. And here on the right-hand side are some slightly sort of more subtle things about the long term, how you're going to actually build your business revolves around that leadership quality we talked about and about having some view of where you're going and being devoted to getting there and ensuring that you bring along your team with you and making sure that your business actually grows in a way which makes it a business, not just a social network or a club or a family affair. So, let's move on now and think about the other people. The other really important message I'm trying to get across here is it's not all about you. It's not all about me. It's not all about any one person. It's actually just too complicated. And furthermore, other people don't want to deal just with you. It's not going to work. One-person businesses aren't going to build global successes. Customers, for example, want to deal with a whole company. They don't want to deal with an individual. They don't want the same voice answering the phone as does the support line, as does the sales, as does... It's just not going to work. There's too much to do. And investors, as I told you, want to invest in teams because they know this, because they know that customers want to deal with whole organizations of diversity and scope and skill. And Shai mentioned these before. Just to illustrate, in my business, my last business in Cypher, I started my business with my brother. So we had me, I'm the CEO, and my brother, he's the chief technology officer, at the beginning. And by the time we IPO'd 4 years later, the management team, the executive team of the business, consisted of all of these things. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 people in the team. So we grew that team very rapidly at the top of the organization. And I consider all of those people to be my peers, never mind what the titles say. Yes, somebody's the leader. But actually, it was a team. And it was a team because I needed to add to my front person skills, my brother's technical skills, I needed to add a finance guy who could help us to ensure that everything actually added up and that we remained cash flow positive. The president was the person who ran the sales organization, 2 VPs of sales who ran regions within the sales organization, someone who ran marketing globally, and someone who ran engineering, who actually delivered all the crazy fantasies that my brother, the chief technology officer, thought up. So that's a significantly larger team, not just a team of one or two, than we started out with. Now, the question then is for you to evaluate your own capabilities. Which of these people are you going to be? You might not be the person like me, but you might well be one of these other kinds of people. We've talked about the leader. Technologist, coming up with the innovation is crucially important. It's different, though, from actually delivering that innovation. Having somebody who thinks about the sort of fantasy vision of where you're trying to get to is really, really important. But it turns out those people tend not to be able to produce products. They just produce visions. And somebody actually has to run, in a technology business, an engineering function to ensure that delivery works well. So my brother, who's a fantastic technologist, could always build me a demo of something which had absolutely one path through it in which it would actually work. As long as you pressed the right buttons in the right order and clicked in the right place, it would work. And I could use that as a demo and I could sell it. But you could never give it to a customer because they press all the wrong buttons and then it would stop working. And that's what the engineering people are for. They actually make you a product. Operations and finance, keeping the whole enterprise working, dealing with legals, financials, cash management, HR, all those kinds of things. Those are desperately important back office functions. It turns out if you want to be the boss, you end up being a kind of barrack room accountant and lawyer and so forth. So I'm now far better qualified than I wish to be on questions of international accounting principles and HR law in several nations. But having somebody who was my straight man who would ensure that I actually got this kind of stuff right was crucially important. And he, interestingly enough, was the guy we hired next after the two founders. So before anything else, I hired a CFO, COO, to make sure that the back office ran smoothly. And then I started building out the rest of this organization. Sales and marketing people are very interesting people. I've been having this argument with one of my current investment CEOs in the last month or so. I showed him a really excellent salesperson, and he interviewed this person, and I followed up afterwards with him and said, "What did you think of the salesperson?" And he said, "I hated him." And I said, "You might not be the best person to choose the salespeople." It turns out, I hope there aren't too many salespeople in the room, it turns out a lot of really good salespeople are really people you don't want as friends. They're just not. They're just not. Because what makes them really great salespeople is that they just try a little bit too hard. They're just a little bit too shiny. They're just a little bit too persistent. And that means that they do a great job in getting the orders in, which is what you want them to do. But, you know, it doesn't mean you actually have to like them. So, you know, it's really important to accept that this kind of function is necessary in your organization, but you don't have to feel that you want to be one of those either to be able to be successful. So figure it out, and hopefully if you're thinking about a business already yourself, you're thinking about not just being you, but probably having a team of one or two other people to join you in that business. And what I want you to go away and think about is, where are the gaps? There must still be some stuff missing. Shai mentioned, you know, the four engineers in a business plan mistake, which we're particularly good at making this mistake in Cambridge because we're quite long on engineers. And, you know, the tendency is that you kind of put four guys, girls in a room and, you know, they come together with a plan and they completely fail to notice that somebody has to do legals or somebody has to do accounting or somebody has to, you know, be the salesperson. It's not going to fly if you don't fill in the gaps. Now, I just have some practical experiences to relate here about this process of building teams. I'm very lucky to have a brother who's very smart, smarter than me. By the way, he's got a Cambridge PhD, so it's all right. You know, that path does work. But the reality is not everybody is as lucky as I am. So where are you going to get these other people? They might be sitting next to you, of course. Hopefully you've come to network and meet other possible members of your team at interesting events like Enterprise Tuesday. There are many more. And, you know, sometimes there are solutions which I guess would now be called spin-outs. And the story of Arm being founded, we know there's some Arm people here tonight. They probably know this story, which I will now tell completely wrongly, and they'll criticise me afterwards, but here's my version of what happened in the foundation of Arm. I think it's really interesting. I was actually there. When Acorn decided they wanted to spin out a chip company, they recruited a guy to run it, a CEO, a guy called Robin Saxby, who'd come from the semiconductor industry, and he was introduced to the team of people who'd already designed the Arm chip, the very first device within Acorn. He knew that he needed to get them involved, but he didn't know what they were capable of. So he used a device which I hope, as Cambridge people, you are going to approve of. He took them all to the pub, and he gave them beer. And he spent many hours in the pub talking to them. And at the end of the afternoon in the pub, he said, OK, you're going to be in charge of sales, you're going to be in charge of marketing, you're going to be in charge of engineering. So he made an evaluation of how this team of people was going to be capable of divvying up these roles. They were all engineers, but he assigned them roles on the basis of his divination of their personality types, and this was extremely successful. These people took these roles. They didn't know that they could do them. They didn't necessarily have any form to show that they could carry them out, except, I guess, the guy who got to be in charge of engineering. And they went away and successfully built a multi-billion dollar global business on the back of that approach to team building. Robin had a bunch of guys. He had to make it work, ideally, with the resources he had. He didn't have significant additional money. They raised essentially £1 million to get the business started. It was profitable from the get-go, and it remained profitable throughout its history on the back of a team of guys who spent an afternoon in a pub and agreed to take on the roles they were given. That's not a common story, but that's an example of how any solution can apply. You may consider using a recruiter. Now, you may be able to see from the question that I've posed here that I'm not necessarily a fan of recruiters, and gentle apologies to any recruiters in the room. The problem with recruiters is that recruiters get between you and understanding the people that you're recruiting, and I don't think that's a good thing. I think as an entrepreneur, I want to actually meet the people and I want to make my own decision. I want to be Robin Saxby in the pub. I want to decide by talking to people whether or not they're any good. So I want to get straight to the interview. And yeah, recruiters can be useful to kind of build a big funnel of people and then let you interview some of them. But actually, they charge a lot of money for that. And I think these days, their days are numbered. You know, these days, you know that you can do things on LinkedIn. You know you can do things with social network. You know you can do things that probably bypass them. And the other thing you can do is you can emulate other people and you can poach ideas and people from other organizations. My favorite recruiting model is to ask people who are in charge of a hire, who is the person who you've met in the last 6 months who you've most admired who did this job well? at any organisation, who's the person who you really thought, God, I really wish I worked with that person. I really wish that person worked for me. And, you know, that kind of model of thinking about where could you go steal the resource from somewhere else is good. And we have a local software firm here who've got this down to a fine art. Our friends at Redgate Software have a fantastic model. Redgate rented an ice cream van and drove it round the science park, parking it outside each company's offices in turn, ringing the bell, handing out free ice creams wrapped in a recruitment leaflet inviting people to join Redgate Software. And this was really effective. People left other companies and joined Redgate Software on the back of a free ice cream and a recruitment. You know, that's the spirit, isn't it? That's the kind of thing we like. So I'm just going to bring this to a close by telling you what investors really look for. It does turn out that there are actually a couple of other things. It is really genuinely the most important thing to have a great team. It turns out it does actually matter that you also have a really large market opportunity, because investors are interested in investing in businesses that are going to get really big. And that means, ideally, not just that lots of people have the problem which you're going to solve, but that lots of people have the problem that you're going to solve everywhere in the world, not just in the UK, for instance. I'm talking to some lovely people this week who make some excellent software that does something really clever for the NHS, and it's no use anywhere else in the world. And I probably won't invest in that business because the NHS is big and it spends a lot of money, but it isn't the whole world. And I'm interested in investing in businesses that can do that. And lastly, and sorry to the engineers in the audience, the least important thing, of course it's very important, but the least important thing is the technology, is the innovation, is the idea. You might not have expected that. Yes, it matters. In fact, it's the whole business in some sense. But actually, I kind of believe that you can probably deliver the technology that you're telling me you can deliver. I really don't worry about it too much. And you know what? It's going to be your problem. If I write you a check and invest in your business, you're going to have to go and deliver it. So I don't worry about that until the end. At the beginning, I worry about, are you going to be able to crawl over broken glass to get the job done? Do an insane number of people have the problem that you're going to solve? And how great is your innovation that's going to enable you to do it? You will see that team is quite important, but some other things are too. Thank you very much.
So thanks, Alex. What you're going to get is... I've really got to contrast some of my background, because Alex has been, as always, enthusiastic and forthright. And if I'm not as enthusiastic and forthright as him, because I've come off a plane, travelled overnight, so if my voice trails anything, that's my excuses in. But so Alex described how he avoided going to university. I'm one of these people who kind of followed the traditional pathway that some of you will relate to. So I have memories of sitting where you're sitting 30 years ago, listening to obscure lectures on computational fluid mechanics, which some of you may relate to. And I was an academic. And then one day I woke up and realized I was fed up of being poor. And that was my motivation. So I'd kind of bought into this whole thing of, getting a PhD, having a publishing track record and everything else. And so I came very late to this game compared to Alex, much, much later. And I'm, of course, much older than Alex, and I don't have a ponytail. But I did used to have very long hair. And I probably wouldn't pass the test that American politicians have to pass as well. So, it's just... Right, that's fine, yeah. So being, if you like, coming from a more academic tradition, you'll find that my slides and my framework is slightly more structured in the sense of people complain, saying, why do you have to produce Excel spreadsheets? Why can't you just explain what you mean? What I want to talk about is teams, of course, and it's from a slightly different perspective. I can chime with all the things that Alex has said because they're all very, very good points. But I guess my own experience in teams comes from two areas. One is building a number of companies myself, which have actually gone on to build other companies and other businesses. So Shai said we've built a lot of technology companies, not all in the Cambridge area, some in other parts of the UK, some outside, some in the US, and more recently some in India. So that's one set of experiences, is really building teams of people who are going to help other people build businesses. And then the second is the experience from the teams in the companies that I've either invested in or I've been actively involved in. So you'll see some of those things come through, I hope, in the next few minutes. So I think, you know, that this question of leadership is talked about a lot, but I think it's terribly important, because a leader sets, you know, the style and the culture, and not in isolation, but with the other members of the team in an interactive way. So if I talk about, I'll give you three examples, three very different examples of companies. One is an alpha entrepreneur type environment. Somebody a little bit like Alex, in the sense that he was at a university in the UK, one of the top technology universities, and he dropped out halfway through. So not quite, you know, Alex dropped out before he even bothered to go to university, but this particular guy dropped out, and he was the kind of guy who would have crawled across all the way from the top to down here and across broken glass, and he had a passion for what he did. And he followed that model for how what he was going to do, and nothing was an obstacle. Nothing was an obstacle. Everything was a challenge, not a problem. And in that particular case, the style that he had around him was one of what I would call hero culture, hero worship. So, you know, he was idolized by his team. Now, that created some problems, because people were very loath to confront him because he had such a domineering personality. And the work we had to do there was to help him to understand that not everybody could live life at the pace that he lived it at. And when I talk about living life at a pace, this is a guy who would work 18 hours a day, go out clubbing, and be first man into the office at 7 o'clock in the morning with 2 hours sleep. Right? He built a very successful telecoms company, which he sold for about $100 million. And what's he doing now? He's doing it the third time round. Okay, so that's one kind of person, alpha entrepreneur. The second is an example of somebody who had a bit of a background like mine. He'd done a PhD, he'd worked in industry, and he came to run a company that we had invested in, which is a very high-tech company. And the challenge for him was that he understood leadership, but he had this problem with recognizing salespeople that Alex referred to. So I would send people to him, and he would say, I can't stand this person, can't figure them out. They're not intellectual enough, they're not methodical enough. And the team around that kind of a person had to be very, very different. And then the third kind of leadership example I'd like to talk about was somebody, in fact, who is now the chairman of the largest digital media company in the world. And he was an ex-investment banker who'd walked away with a nice payoff, and he and his friend decided to start a digital media company. Why? Did they know anything about digital? Did they know anything about media? No. They just thought it sounded like a good idea. And the way they built their business was they hung out in a bar in Camden, in London, and they decided to have a week of what they call a drink-in to try and recruit the team. So they basically paid for champagne behind the bar. And interestingly for me, I was in there the third night they were in there. I'd never met them before, and we got chatting, and that company is now the largest digital media company in the world. You see their little logo. If you look at your newspaper, you'll say, you know, who owns the digital rights. And they're bigger than Corbis, which is owned by Bill Gates. And the thing about the leadership style there, it was very, very different. And I'll give you a little anecdote of the leadership style. We'd bought a company in the US, and it was a Seattle company, and they were really nervous about what a British company was going to bring in terms of an acquisition. And on the flight over, I sat next to him and I said, you're going to have to win the hearts and minds. You've got one shot, because all these people are going to be out of the door. You bought a company, you haven't bought the people. And he said, no, I'm working on it. Just trust me. So when we got there, we were in Seattle, and he sat down on the floor when he arrived in the offices on a beanbag. And all these people were sort of standing around. And then he talked about the power of the written word and Shakespeare for half an hour. Right? And all these people who were the Seattle geeks were just completely disoriented. And in the end, he said, well, we're going to sort of do what I just talked about, but we're going to do it with pictures now. Right? So that's leadership. That's the ability to see something. So the last point I want to make is that most businesses I've been associated with haven't failed because the technology didn't work. In fact, if you're associated with UK tech companies, Cambridge tech companies, the technology pretty much works, or people are smart enough to figure it out. Most of the things that I've involved in that have failed because the management team couldn't make it work. And that's probably the largest. If you look at the things we've done, the failures have been where you couldn't get the team to work together, where there wasn't alignment, there wasn't clarity, and that dysfunctional team problem is the biggest problem, I would say, in tech companies. So, a little bit about team formation. I think psychologists like to talk about it, but I like the words here because when you start a company, you have this kind of, you could have all the sexual metaphors you want in terms of relationships. You know, there's a forming phase when people are sort of getting around and saying, you know, what should we do? How we get on? And it's the period of great enthusiasm. It's early days. And then, after a little while, you start having your first fights. So then you have the storming phase. Because when you're trying to work towards a goal that you commonly share, the excitement and passion takes you a certain distance. And then the disagreements start coming along, saying, well, we're not sure we want to do this. Why can't we do this? Why can't we do that? So the storming period is great. And you have to have those storming periods because without that, there is no reality check. Life isn't hunky-dory. You start off and you change your mind. You may have a business plan and a model which just fails to work, and you need to change your model completely. So the storming is very, very important because if you avoid storming, then you're not really gelling your teams. And then there's this what we call norming, where basically you kind of get used to each other and say, you know, I hate that guy. But you know, and I wouldn't invite him to my parties, but you know what? I appreciate what he does or what she does. And that norming is quite important because new kinds of relationships are formed in this. People change their perceptions of their team members. Sometimes team members leave. And my view on that is, you know, consenting adults, and if people leave, that's okay. You know, you shouldn't get too hung up about it, provided you're focused on what you're trying to do. And then finally, hopefully, you know, once your norming phase is gone, this is when you really start to gel and, you know, you're performing as a team. And that's the bit when you start to really realize how you can grow companies fast and you can make them happen. Now, it's fair to say that many companies never get to that performing phase. If you look at the percentage of companies that have started and failed, it's because people have failed to get their act together in that way. So, this is a slide that cognitive behavioral psychologists like to use. So what that's really saying is that, you know, you need to establish norms and can lead to conflict. In my view, conflict is a great thing. Conflict leads to progress. You know, if all of you sat in a room and agreed on what you're trying to do, there'd be no progress. So when I meet teams, I'm always looking for teams where I can see that there'll be people who will have an internal debate, change each other's minds. If there's a team where the leader makes all the speeches and everybody sits there quietly and doesn't challenge the leader, I kind of want to dig around the back and find out, is this really what's going on? Because if in every team that we look at, I'm not just looking at the leader, I'm looking at the other people around them to say, how much can they influence, how much can they change attitudes of the leader who's there now? And quite often you find that leadership changes in early stage businesses. People who've been number twos, number threes step up to the plate, and that's not a bad thing. Sometimes people get lucky. You know, I mean, Alex started a business with his brother. And so, you know, if you have a familial relationship. I should say the other interesting thing is when Alex was talking, I realized one of the businesses I talked about, this alpha entrepreneur who was completely and utterly driven, he had his first hire was his brother. And his brother had an engineering degree out of Cambridge. And they rowed and they argued and they fought for 6 months about everything, literally everything. But that basically laid the foundations for a very successful business because by the end of it, they really had clarity about what they were trying to do. So this is the point, is, you know, moderate levels of sort of argument are supposed to be associated with better decisions. Some of my colleagues who've been involved in businesses with me will tell you that moderate is perhaps an underestimate. So, as I said, you know, being an engineer and a mathematician previously, I like models, but I like simple pictorial models. And so this is actually based on work we did. We've done a lot of companies, and we said, where are the places where companies come unstuck? You know, when you're growing a company, is there any way we can identify those places where there are hurdles, there are chasms? And we've come up with a relatively simple model, call it the triple chasm model. Those of you who read technology books, anybody here read Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm? Right, so and then he's written books about tornadoes and stuff like that as well. It turns out that Geoffrey Moore, because he comes from a Californian Silicon Valley culture driven by VCs, the chasm he's talking about is actually the third chasm in my view, which is the bit about scaling up a business, which is where the VCs are really interested in investing. There are two other chasms. And the first chasm is actually turning your idea into a prototype or a reality. And this came about because of the work we do with technology-based entrepreneurship. It's very important to understand how people take an idea and actually turn it into something tangible. So often we'll see people in Cambridge or in Imperial or York or Southampton or Edinburgh who think because they've had a great idea, you know, they should go and raise money. I'm with Alex here. If you can stay away from VCs, please do. Try and do as much as you can. You know, the old friends, family, and fools, the three Fs. Good source of money. And the best source of money for us to grow a business is money from customers. That really is true. So there are three chasms. The first is this chasm really around taking an idea and turning it into a prototype or a product. The second chasm, I think, is the most critical one. We're trying to figure out the business model. Just because you've built something doesn't mean somebody's going to buy it. And my favorite personal scar story is I was involved in the early days of in-car sat-nav. We had a company we'd started which was way ahead of the people who now have the global market lead, TomTom. And this is a British company run by some software engineers out of Reading. And we made a lot of mistakes in that company. But what we hadn't realized was that just because we'd built a product that 100 IT managers liked buying and installing in their cars and fiddling with, that we'd figured out how to provide something in a box that would be sold in Halfords, where the primary test was whether it could be sub £50 and whether it would fit into a handbag that a lady might take to a dinner party. And I say lady because I don't know many men who carry handbags, but I do know some, and it's a cultural thing. They're all in Italy, by the way. So the point, the second chasm is one about business models. And you'd say, well, how does this relate to teams? But the point is that teams got to figure out not just how you build something, but they've got to figure out how you're going to make it, how you're going to price it, and how you're going to sell it. And that business model phase is the one that most tech companies fail on. If they figured that out, then the scale-up becomes much, much easier. So we've actually written about the triple chasm model, and for those of you interested, I can refer you later to stuff. So Alex has talked about this. Though, to my mind, these are the four critical roles. You need somebody who's driving stuff. I always think that, you know, you're always in a technology company, you have a CEO, you have a CTO. That pairing of somebody who's driving the business, somebody who's looking at the technology is important. But then you need somebody who basically counts the money and organizes stuff. And then somebody's going to go and sell the stuff, take it to market. So in all the companies, if you said, what's the order in which we've hired, is usually you have the CEO, there's a CTO, and then it varies. In some cases, we've actually hired a COO. In other cases, we've hired a salesperson. Depends on what you're trying to do. Now, this is all about the kind of boring stuff. When you're running a company, you're running a team, you've got to figure out these are all the things you're going to have to do. And as Alex said, you know, he's done all of them and more. So I could tell you a lot about option schemes. I could tell you about UK tax law. I could tell you about legal agreements. I could tell you about IP clauses. You need to know all these things. You need to know enough in order to know whether they matter and enough in order to know how you can avoid incurring huge bills. So the last thing in the world you want to do is go and talk to a lawyer and accountant before you actually know what you want them to do, because you know they have this hourglass charging model where the hourglass, you see the sand floating down and you can see the bill racking up. Are there any lawyers in the audience, by the way? Gosh, none. Accountants?
This is an
entrepreneurship club. I have met entrepreneur lawyers and accountants. Many years ago, I actually partnered with a lawyer who ran a big media law firm in London. and they were pioneered the whole art of marketing for law firms. And they worked in the creative industry. And what was interesting, for me, the thing that really told me this was a guy different from all of the lawyers was when I said, give me an overview of the music industry, of the creative arts industry. And he said, well, you know, he said, it's all about gradation. He said, on the left-hand side, we have all the people who work in television. And then you have the people who work in movies. And it goes on. And then finally, you have the people who work in music at the far end. And I said, so what's the common currency, this scale? And he said, it's the amount of cocaine they take. So a little bit of methodology works. You know, I think Alex talked about the hiring. I like hiring in pubs. I like putting people out of situations where you can kind of... Stylized interviews are terrible. You know, you invite somebody in, the headhunter says, you know, here are six CVs. They come into the room and they expect to be grilled and they packaged up their CV. You know, you're not really going to get to know somebody, so you've got to probe a little bit. And I used to work in Shai's referred to some consulting companies in the Cambridge area. There was the CCL, which is way old. Then there was PA Technology. Out of that, this company called Generics, where I was, one of the founders, TTP, the Technology Partnership. Gerald Davison is going to come and talk. Well, my experience at PA, the way I was hired, should tell you something about why some of these companies have been successful. I was invited for an interview and turned up, and the chap interviewing me said, this is great, you know, we'd really like to hire you straight away, we'll be in touch. Nothing happened for 3 months. So I rang up and said, you know, you said you were interested, what's going on? Oh yeah, he said, but we'd like you to come up again. So I came up and I met somebody else who interviewed me and said, yeah, this sounds really great, you know, we'll sort it all out. I had about 4 rounds of this. And then finally I said, look, I'm about to accept another job. Do you really want to hire me? And they said, yeah, great. So a contract arrived in the post, but it said I was reporting to somebody I'd never met. And so I turned up. The first day I turned up in down the road in Melbourne, and this guy met me, and he said, it's great to have you on board. It's a shame I haven't got more time. I'm going on holiday tomorrow. But there's your desk, and I'm sure you'll figure it out. I'll be back in about 4 weeks. Right? And so I sat at my desk and sort of sat there first day, and this chap walked along and he said, so what sort of stuff do you do? You look new, and I described my skill set. He said, would you like to work on my project? And I said, yeah, I'd love to work on your project. And so I arrived as somebody who was working on digital imaging systems, and I found that this person basically had a healthcare device which needed some software writing. And I hadn't written much code in my life before, but boy, I became a good code writer that week because I just thought, got to find something to do. And that tells you something, because they had a philosophy. The philosophies I discovered later on was that they only hired people who really tried very hard to get in. They didn't give up. Yeah, that was the whole philosophy. And we used it at Generics as well, and people used to complain about that. Now, I don't know if there are any old Generics people here, but they'll recognize the model, which was we would have this anarchic hiring methodology. But we hired some really good people, and people suddenly discovered they could do things that they didn't know they could do. And that's great, because then you've got multifaceted people. So all that's great, but now I've got a model here, which is based on Belbin. And Shai's saying, time's running on. So Belbin is just one set of methodologies. There are lots of tools that people use for being able to assess people, try and find people who fit the right kind of profile, the right roles. And so if you're interested, go and read about it. But Belbin has a lovely model which describes all kinds of different people. Most people have 2-3 different characteristics. And when you look at this and you typecast them, then you start to understand things like, why didn't Tony Blair and Gordon Brown get on, really? Yeah, it's not because they hated each other. It's not because they believed in different things. But there were some fundamental issues about personality. And it's kind of interesting. If you look at the life choices people make, the people that they work with, people they end up in relationships with, they're driven by some of these things. And so entrepreneurial teams need a whole set of things, and Alex has talked about this already. You know, you need skill sets, you need vision, We need integrity. You know, if you start with a leader who basically has passion and integrity, then that's, in my mind, that's sort of half the battle. Because all the other things they can pick up along the way. So a little bit about growing a business, because all of you are going to be in startup mode. But the thing to remember is I talked about the three chasms. The needs of a business change as businesses change. And that's something that's quite hard to handle if you don't understand what's going on. And so VCs usually have a very simplistic thing which says, oh, you know, we have a CEO who's good for the bit, now we want a new CEO, so let's hire somebody expensive, bring them in from a corporate environment. And they usually get it wrong, in my view.